You had not had anything to drink? Why, yes, Your Honor, I had. What did you have? I had a bottle of something. I don't know what it was. Something that burned. There was again a laugh around the courtroom, stopping suddenly as the magistrate looked up and frowned. Have you ever been arrested before? He asked abruptly. The question took Jurgis aback. I, he stammered. Tell me the truth now, commanded the other sternly. Yes, Your Honor, said Jurgis. How often? Only once, Your Honor. What for? For knocking down my boss, Your Honor. I was working in the stockyards and he. I see, said His Honor. I guess that will do. You ought to stop drinking if you can't control yourself. 10 days and costs. Next case. Jurgis gave vent to a cry of dismay, cut off suddenly by the policeman who seized him by the collar. He was jerked out of the way into a room with the convicted prisoners, where he sat and wept like a child in his impotent rage. It seemed monstrous to him that policemen and judges should esteem his word as nothing in comparison with the bartender's. Poor Jurgis could not know that the owner of the saloon paid $5 each week to the policeman alone for Sunday privileges and general favors, nor that the pugilist bartender was one of the most trusted henchmen of the Democratic leader of the district, and had helped only a few months before to hustle out a record-breaking vote as a testimonial to the magistrate, who had been made the target of odious, kid-gloved reformers. Jurgis was driven out to the Bridewell for the second time. In his tumbling around, he had hurt his arm again, and so could not work, but had to be attended by the physician. Also, his head and his eye had to be tied up, and so he was a pretty-looking object when, the second day after his arrival, he went out into the exercise court and encountered Jack Duane. The young fellow was so glad to see Jurgis that he almost hugged him. "By God, if it isn't the stinker!" he cried. "And what is it? Have you been through a sausage machine?" "No," said Jurgis. "But I've been in a railroad wreck and a fight." And then, while some of the other prisoners gathered round, he told his wild story. Most of them were incredulous, but Duane knew that Jurgis could never have made up such a yarn as that. "Hard luck, old man," he said when they were alone. "But maybe it's taught you a lesson." "I've learned some things since I saw you last," said Jurgis mournfully. Then he explained how he had spent the last summer hoboing it, as the phrase was. "And you?" he asked finally. "Have you been here ever since?" "Lord, no," said the other. "I only came in the day before yesterday. It's the second time they sent me up on a trumped-up charge. I've had hard luck and can't pay them what they want. Why don't you quit Chicago with me, Jurgis?" "I've no place to go," said Jurgis sadly. "Neither have I," replied the other, laughing lightly. "But we'll wait till we get out and see." In the Bridewell, Jurgis met few who had been there the last time, but he met scores of others, old and young, of exactly the same sort. It was like breakers upon a beach. There was new water, but the wave looked just the same. He strolled about and talked with them, and the biggest of them told tales of their prowess, while those who were weaker or younger and inexperienced gathered round and listened in admiring silence. The last time he was there, Jurgis had thought of little but his family. But now he was free to listen to these men, and to realize that he was one of them, that their point of view was his point of view, and that the way they kept themselves alive in the world was the way he meant to do it in future. And so, when he was turned out of prison again, without a penny in his pocket, he went straight to Jack Duane. He went full of humility and gratitude, for Duane was a gentleman and a man with a profession, and it was remarkable that he should be willing to throw in his lot with a humble working man. One who had even been a beggar and a tramp. Jurgis could not see what help he could be to him. He did not understand that a man like himself, who could be trusted to stand by anyone who was kind to him, was as rare among criminals as among any other class of men. The address Jurgis had was a garret room in the ghetto district, the home of a pretty little French girl, Duane's mistress, who sewed all day and eked out her living by prostitution. He had gone elsewhere, she told Jurgis. He was afraid to stay there now on account of the police. The new address was a cellar dive whose proprietor said that he had never heard of Duane, but after he had put Jurgis through a catechism, he showed him a back stairs which led to a fence in the rear of a pawnbroker's shop, and thence to a number of assignation rooms, in one of which Duane was hiding. Duane was glad to see him. He was without a cent of money, he said. and had been waiting for Jurgis to help him get some. He explained his plan. In fact, he spent the day in laying bare to his friend the criminal world of the city and in showing him how he might earn himself a living in it. That winter, he would have a hard time on account of his arm and because of an unwanted fit of activity of the police. But so long as he was unknown to them, he would be safe if he were careful. Here, at Papa Hansen's, so they called the old man who kept the dive, he might rest at ease, for Papa Hansen was square, would stand by him so long as he paid, and gave him an hour's notice if there were to be a police raid. Also, Rosensteg, the pawnbroker, would buy anything he had for a third of its value and guarantee to keep it hidden for a year. There was an oil stove in the little cupboard of a room, and they had some supper, and then about 11 o'clock at night they sallied forth together by a rear entrance to the place, Duane armed with a slung shot. They came to a residence district, and he sprung up a lamppost and blew out the light, and then the two dodged into the shelter of an area step and hid in silence. Pretty soon a man came by, a working man, and they let him go. Then after a long interval came the heavy tread of a policeman, and they held their breath till he was gone. Though half frozen, they waited a full quarter of an hour after that, and then again came footsteps, walking briskly. Duane nudged Jurgis, and the instant the man had passed, they rose up. Duane stole out as silently as a shadow, and a second later Jurgis heard a thud and a stifled cry. He was only a couple of feet behind, and he leaped to stop the man's mouth, while Duane held him fast by the arms, as they had agreed. But the man was limp and showed a tendency to fall, and so Jurgis had only to hold him by the collar, while the other, with swift fingers, went through his pockets, ripping open first his overcoat and then his coat and then his vest, searching inside and out, and transferring the contents into his own pockets. At last, after feeling of the man's fingers and in his necktie, Duane whispered, "That's all." And then they dragged him to the area and dropped him in. Then Jurgis went one way and his friend the other, walking briskly. The latter arrived first, and Jurgis found him examining the swag. There was a gold watch, for one thing, with a chain and a locket. There was a silver pencil and a matchbox, and a handful of small change, and finally a card case. This last Duane opened feverishly. There were letters and checks and 2 theater tickets, and at last in the back part a wad of bills. He counted them. There was a 20, 5 tens, 4 fives, and 3 ones. Duane drew a long breath.
"That lets us out," he said.
After further examination, they burned the card case and its contents, all but the bills, and likewise the picture of a little girl in the locket. Then Duane took the watch and trinkets downstairs and came back with $16. "The old scoundrel said the case was filled," he said. "It's a lie, but he knows I want the money." They divided up the spoils, and Jurgis got, as his share, $55 and some change. He protested that it was too much, but the other had agreed to divide even. "That was a good haul," he said, "better than the average." When they got up in the morning, Jurgis was sent out to buy a paper. One of the pleasures of committing a crime was the reading about it afterward. "I had a pal that always did it," Duane remarked, laughing, until one day he read that he had left $3,000 in a lower inside pocket of his party's vest. There was a half-column account of the robbery. It was evident that a gang was operating in the neighborhood, said the paper, for it was the third within a week, and the police were apparently powerless. The victim was an insurance agent, and he had lost $110 that did not belong to him. He had chanced to have his name marked on his shirt, otherwise he would not have been identified yet. His assailant had hit him too hard, and he was suffering from concussion of the brain. And also he had been half frozen when found, and would lose 3 fingers of his right hand. The enterprising newspaper reporter had taken all this information to his family and told how they had received it. Since it was Jurgis's first experience, these details naturally caused him some worriment. But the other laughed coolly. It was the way of the game, and there was no helping it. Before long, Jurgis would think no more of it than they did in the yards of knocking out a bullock. "It's a case of us or the other fellow, and I say the other fellow every time," he observed. "Still," said Jurgis reflectively, "he never did us any harm." "He was doing it to somebody as hard as he could, you can be sure of that," said his friend. Duane had already explained to Jurgis that if a man of their trade were known, he would have to work all the time to satisfy the demands of the police.
Therefore, it would be better for Jurgis to stay in hiding and never be seen in public with his pal. But Jurgis soon got very tired of staying in hiding. In a couple of weeks, he was feeling strong and beginning to use his arm, and then he could not stand it any longer. Duane, who had done a job of some sort by himself and made a truce with the powers, brought over Marie, his little French girl, to share with him. But even that did not avail for long, and in the end he had to give up arguing and take Jurgis out and introduce him to the saloons and sporting houses where the big crooks and hold-up men hung out. And so Jurgis got a glimpse of the high-class criminal world of Chicago. The city, which was owned by an oligarchy of businessmen, being nominally ruled by the people, a huge army of graft was necessary for the purpose of effecting the transfer of power. Twice a year, in the spring and fall elections, millions of dollars were furnished by the businessmen and expended by this army. Meetings were held and clever speakers were hired. Bands played and rockets sizzled. Tons of documents and reservoirs of drinks were distributed, and tens of thousands of votes were bought for cash. And this army of graft had, of course, to be maintained the year round. The leaders and organizers were maintained by the businessmen directly, aldermen and legislators, by means of bribes, party officials out of the campaign funds, lobbyists and corporation lawyers in the form of salaries, contractors by means of jobs, labor union leaders by subsidies, and newspaper proprietors and editors by advertisements. The rank and file, however, were either foisted upon the city or else lived off the populace directly. There was the police department and the fire and water departments and the whole balance of the civil list, from the meanest office boy to the head of a city department. And for the horde who could find no room in these, there was the world of vice and crime. There was license to seduce, to swindle and plunder and prey. The law forbade Sunday drinking, and this had delivered the saloon keepers into the hands of the police and made an alliance between them necessary. The law forbade prostitution, and this had brought the madams into the combination. It was the same with the gambling housekeeper and the pool room man, and the same with any other man or woman who had a means of getting graft and was willing to pay over a share of it. The green goods man and the highway man, the pickpocket and the sneak thief, and the receiver of stolen goods, the seller of adulterated milk, of stale fruit and diseased meat, the proprietor of unsanitary tenements, the fake doctor and the usurer, the beggar and the pushcart man, the prize fighter and the professional slugger, the racetrack tout, the procurer, the white slave agent, and the expert seducer of young girls. All of these agencies of corruption were banded together and leagued in blood brotherhood with the politician and the police. More often than not, they were one and the same person. The police captain would own the brothel he pretended to raid, and the politician would open his headquarters in his saloon. Hinky Dink, or Bathhouse John, or others of that ilk, were proprietors of the most notorious dives in Chicago, and also the Gray Wolves of the city council, who gave away the streets of the city to the businessman. And those who patronized their places were the gamblers and prize fighters who set the law at defiance, and the burglars and hold-up men who kept the whole city in terror. On election day, all these powers of vice and crime were one power. They could tell within 1% what the vote of their district would be, and they could change it at an hour's notice. A month ago, Jurgis had all but perished of starvation upon the streets, and now suddenly, as by the gift of a magic key, he had entered into a world where money and all the good things of life came freely. He was introduced by his friend to an Irishman named Buck Halloran, who was a political worker and on the inside of things. This man talked with Jurgis for a while and then told him that he had a little plan by which a man who looked like a working man might make some easy money. But it was a private affair and had to be kept quiet. Jurgis expressed himself as agreeable, and the other took him that afternoon, it was Saturday, to a place where city laborers were being paid off. The paymaster sat in a little booth with a pile of envelopes before him and two policemen standing by. Jurgis went, according to directions, and gave the name of Michael O'Flaherty, and received an envelope, which he took around the corner and delivered to Halloran, who was waiting for him in a saloon. Then he went again and gave the name of Johann Schmidt, and a third time and gave the name of Sergei Reminitsky. Halloran had quite a list of imaginary working men, and Jurgis got an envelope for each one. For this work, he received $5. and was told that he might have it every week so long as he kept quiet. As Jurgis was excellent at keeping quiet, he soon won the trust of Buck Halloran and was introduced to others as a man who could be depended upon. This acquaintance was useful to him in another way also. Before long, Jurgis made his discovery of the meaning of pull, and just why his boss Connor and also the pugilist bartender had been able to send him to jail. One night there was a given ball, the benefit of One-Eyed Larry, a lame man who played the violin in one of the big high-class houses of prostitution on Clark Street and was a wag and a popular character on the levee. This ball was held in a big dance hall and was one of the occasions when the city's powers of debauchery gave themselves up to madness. Jurgis attended and got half insane with drink and began quarreling over a girl. His arm was pretty strong by then, and he set to work to clean out the place and ended in a cell in the police station. The police station being crowded to the doors and stinking with bums, Jurgis did not relish staying there to sleep off his liquor and sent for Halloran, who called up the district leader and had Jurgis bailed out by telephone at 4 o'clock in the morning. When he was arraigned that same morning, the district leader had already seen the clerk of the court and explained that Jurgis Rutkus was a decent fellow who had been indiscreet. And so Jurgis was fined $10, and the fine was suspended, which meant that he did not have to pay it, and never would have to pay it, unless somebody chose to bring it up against him in the future. Among the people Jurgis lived with now, money was valued according to an entirely different standard from that of the people of Packingtown. Yet strange as it may seem, he did a great deal less drinking than he had as a working man. He had not the same provocations of exhaustion and hopelessness. He had now something to work for, to struggle for. He soon found that if he kept his wits about him, he would come upon new opportunities, and being naturally an active man, he not only kept sober himself, but helped to steady his friend, who was a good deal fonder of both wine and women than he. One thing led to another. In the saloon where Jurgis met Buck Halloran, he was sitting late one night with Duane when a country customer, a buyer for an out-of-town merchant, came in a little more than half-piped. There was no one else in the place but the bartender, and as the man went out again, Jurgis and Duane followed him. He went round the corner, and in a dark place, made by a combination of the elevated railroad and an unrented building, Jurgis leapt forward and shoved a revolver under his nose, while Duane, with his hat pulled over his eyes, went through the man's pockets with lightning fingers. They got his watch and his wad, and were round the corner again and into the saloon before he could shout more than once. The bartender, to whom they had tipped the wink, had the cellar door open for them, and they vanished, making their way by a secret entrance to a brothel next door. From the roof of this, there was access to three similar places beyond. By means of these passages, the customers of any one place could be gotten out of the way, in case a falling out with the police chanced to lead to a raid, and also it was necessary to have a way of getting a girl out of reach in case of an emergency. Thousands of them came to Chicago answering advertisements for servants and factory hands, and found themselves trapped by fake employment agencies and locked up in a body house. It was generally enough to take all their clothes away from them, but sometimes they would have to be doped and kept prisoners for weeks. In meantime, their parents might be telegraphing the police and even coming on to see why nothing was done. Occasionally, there was no way of satisfying them but to let them search the place to which the girl had been traced. For his help in this little job, the bartender received 20 of the 130-odd dollars that the pair secured. And naturally, this put them on friendly terms with him. And a few days later, he introduced them to a little sheeny named Goldberger, one of the runners of the sporting house where they had been hidden. After a few drinks, Goldberger began, with some hesitation, to narrate how he had a quarrel over his best girl with a professional card sharp who had hit him in the jaw. The fellow was a stranger in Chicago, and if he was found some night with his head cracked, there would be no one to care very much. Jurgis, who by this time would cheerfully have cracked the heads of all the gamblers in Chicago, inquired what would be coming to him, at which the Jew became still more confidential, and said that he had some tips on the New Orleans races, which he got direct from the police captain of the district, whom he had got out of a bad scrape and who stood in with a big syndicate of horse owners. Duane took all this in at once, but Jurgis had to have the whole racetrack situation explained to him before he realized the importance of such an opportunity. There was the gigantic racing trust, It owned the legislatures in every state in which it did business. It even owned some of the big newspapers and made public opinion. There was no power in the land that could oppose it unless perhaps it were the Pool Room Trust. It built magnificent racing parks all over the country, and by means of enormous purses it lured the people to come, and then it organized a gigantic shell game whereby it plundered them of hundreds of millions of dollars every year. Horse racing had once been a sport, but nowadays it was a business. A horse could be doped and doctored, undertrained or overtrained. It could be made to fall at any moment, or its gait could be broken by lashing it with a whip, which all the spectators would take to be a desperate effort to keep it in the lead. There were scores of such tricks, and sometimes it was the owners who played them and made fortunes. Sometimes it was the jockeys and trainers. Sometimes it was outsiders who bribed them, but most of the time it was the chiefs of the trust. Now, for instance, they were having winter racing in New Orleans, and a syndicate was laying out each day's program in advance, and its agents in all the northern cities were milking the pool rooms. The word came by long-distance telephone in a cipher code just a little while before each race, and any man who could get the secret had as good as a fortune. If Jurgis did not believe it, he could try it, said the little Jew. Let them meet at a certain house on the morrow and make a test. Jurgis was willing, and so was Duane, and so they went to one of the high-class pool rooms where brokers and merchants gambled, with society women in a private room. And they put up $10 each upon a horse called Black Beldam, a 6-to-1 shot. And won. For a secret like that, they would have done a good many sluggings. But the next day, Goldberger informed them that the offending gambler had got wind of what was coming to him and had skipped the town. There were ups and downs at the business, but there was always a living, inside of a jail, if not out of it. Early in April, the city elections were due, and that meant prosperity for all the powers of graft. Jurgis, hanging around in dives and gambling houses and brothels, met with the heelers of both parties, and from their conversation he came to understand all the ins and outs of the game, and to hear of a number of ways in which he could make himself useful about election time. Buck Halloran was a Democrat, and so Jurgis became a Democrat also, but he was not a bitter one. The Republicans were good fellows, too, and were to have a pile of money in this next campaign. At the last election, the Republicans had paid $4 a vote to the Democrats' $3, and Buck Halloran sat one night playing cards with Jurgis and another man, who told how Halloran had been charged with the job of voting a bunch of 37 newly landed Italians, and how he, the narrator, had met the Republican worker, who was after the very same gang, and how the three had effected a bargain, whereby the Italians were to vote half and half for a glass of beer apiece, while the balance of the fun went to the conspirators. Not long after this, Jurgis, wearying of the risks and vicissitudes of miscellaneous crime, was moved to give up the career for that of a politician. Just at this time, there was a tremendous uproar being raised concerning the alliance between the criminals and the police, for the criminal graft was one in which the businessman had no direct part. It was what is called a sideline, carried by the police. Wide-open gambling and debauchery made the city pleasing to trade, but burglaries and hold-ups did not. One night, it chanced that while Jack Duane was drilling a safe in a clothing store, he was caught red-handed by a night watchman and turned over to a policeman, who chanced to know him well, and who took the responsibility of letting him make his escape. Such a howl from the newspapers followed this that Duane was slated for a sacrifice and barely got out of town in time. And just at that juncture it happened that Jurgis was introduced to a man named Harper, whom he recognized as the night watchman at Brown's, who had been instrumental in making him an American citizen the first year of his arrival at the Yards. The other was interested in the coincidence, but did not remember Jurgis. He had handled too many green ones in his time, he said. He sat in a dance hall with Jurgis and Halloran until 1 or 2 in the morning, exchanging experiences. He had a long story to tell of his quarrel with the superintendent of his department, and how he was now a plain working man, and a good union man as well. It was not until some months afterwards that Jurgis understood that the quarrel with the superintendent had been prearranged, and that Harper was in reality drawing a salary of $20 a week from the Packers for an inside report of his union's secret proceedings. The Yards were seething with agitation just then, said the man, speaking as a unionist. The people of Packingtown had borne about all that they would bear, and it looked as if a strike might begin any week. After this talk, the man made inquiries concerning Jurgis, and a couple of days later he came to him with an interesting proposition. He was not absolutely certain, he said, but he thought that he could get him a regular salary if he would come to Packingtown and do as he was told and keep his mouth shut. Harper, Bush Harper, he was called, was a right-hand man of Mike Scully, the Democratic boss of the stockyards, and in the coming election there was a peculiar situation. There had come to Scully a proposition to nominate a certain rich brewer who lived upon a swell boulevard that skirted the district and who coveted the big badge and the honorable of an alderman. The brewer was a Jew and had no brains, but he was harmless and would put up a rare campaign fund. Scully had accepted the offer and then gone to the Republicans with a proposition. He was not sure that he could manage the Sheeny, and he did not mean to take any chances with his district. Let the Republicans nominate a certain obscure but amiable friend of Scully's, who is now setting 10 pins in the cellar of an Ashland Avenue saloon, and he, Scully, would elect him with the Sheeny's money, and the Republicans might have the glory, which was more than they would get otherwise. In return for this, the Republicans would agree to put up no candidate the following year, when Scully himself came up for re-election as the other alderman from the ward. To this the Republicans had assented at once, but the hell of it was, so Harper explained, that the Republicans were all of them fools. A man had to be a fool to be a Republican in the stockyards, where Scully was king, and they didn't know how to work, and of course it would not do for the Democratic workers, the noble Redskins of the War Whoop League, to support the Republican openly. The difficulty would not have been so great except for another fact. There had been a curious development in stockyard politics in the last year or two, a new party having leaped into being. They were the Socialists, and it was a devil of a mess, said Bush Harper. The one image which the word Socialist brought to Jurgis was of poor little Timosius Kusleika, who had called himself one, and would go out with a couple of other men in a soapbox, and shout himself hoarse on a street corner Saturday nights. Timosius had tried to explain to Jurgis what it was all about, but Jurgis, who was not of an imaginative turn, had never quite got it straight. At present, he was content with his companion's explanation that the Socialists were the enemies of American institutions, could not be bought, and would not combine or make any sort of a dicker. Mike Scully was very much worried over the opportunity which his last deal gave to them. The Stockyards Democrats were furious at the idea of a rich capitalist for their candidate, and while they were changing, they might possibly conclude that a Socialist firebrand was preferable to a Republican bum. And so right here was a chance for Jurgis to make himself a place in the world, explained Bush Harper. He had been a union man, and he was known in the yards as a working man. He must have hundreds of acquaintances, and as he had never talked politics with them, he might come out as a Republican now without exciting the least suspicion. There were barrels of money for the use of those who could deliver the goods, and Jurgis might count upon Mike Scully, who had never yet gone back on a friend. Just what could he do? Jurgis asked in some perplexity, and the other explained in detail. To begin with, he would have to go to the yards and work, and he mightn't relish that, but he would have what he earned, as well as the rest that came to him. He would get active in the union again and perhaps try to get an office, as he, Harper, had. He would tell all his friends the good points of Doyle, the Republican nominee, and the bad ones of the Sheeny, and then Scully would furnish a meeting place, and he would start the Young Men's Republican Association, or something of that sort, and have the rich brewer's best beer by the hogshead, and fireworks and speeches, just like the War Whoop League. Surely Jurgis must know hundreds of men who would like that sort of fun. And there would be the regular Republican leaders and workers to help him out, and they would deliver a big enough majority on election day. When he had heard all this explanation to the end, Jurgis demanded, "But how can I get a job in Packingtown? I'm blacklisted." At which Bush Harper laughed. "I'll attend to that all right," he said. And the other replied, "It's a go, then. I'm your man." And so Jurgis went out to the stockyards again and was introduced to the political lord of the district, the boss of Chicago's mayor. It was Scully who owned the brickyards and the dump and the ice pond, though Jurgis did not know it. It was Scully who was to blame for the unpaved streets in which Jurgis's child had been drowned. It was Scully who had put into office the magistrate who had first sent Jurgis to jail. It was Scully who was a principal stockholder in the company which had sold him the ramshackle tenement and then robbed him of it. But Jurgis knew none of these things, any more than he knew that Scully was but a tool and puppet of the Packers. To him, Scully was a mighty power, the biggest man he had ever met. He was a little, dried-up Irishman whose hands shook. He had a brief talk with his visitor, watching him with his rat-like eyes and making up his mind about him. And then he gave him a note to Mr. Harmon, one of the head managers of Durham's. "The bearer, Jurgis Rutkus, is a particular friend of mine, and I would like you to find him a good place for important reasons. He was once indiscreet, but you will perhaps be so good as to overlook that." Mr. Harmon looked up inquiringly when he read this.
"What does he mean by indiscreet?"
he asked. "I was blacklisted, sir," said Jurgis, at which the other frowned.
"Blacklisted?" he said. "How do you mean?"
And Jurgis turned red with embarrassment. He had forgotten that a blacklist did not exist.
I had difficulty in getting a place," he stammered. "What was the matter?"
"I got into a quarrel with a foreman, not my own boss, sir, and I struck him."
"I see," said the other, and meditated for a few moments. "What do you wish to do?"
he asked. "Anything, sir," said Jurgis. "Only I had a broken arm this winter, and so I have to be careful."
"How would it suit you to be a night watchman?"
"That wouldn't do, sir. I have to be among the men at night."
"I see. Politics. Well, would it suit you to trim hogs?"
"Yes, sir," said Jurgis. And Mr. Harmon called a timekeeper and said, "Take this man to Pat Murphy and tell him to find room for him somehow." And so Jurgis marched into the hog-killing room, a place where, in the days gone by, he had come begging for a job. Now he walked jauntily and smiled to himself, seeing the frown that came to the boss's face as the timekeeper said, "Mr. Harmon says to put this man on." It would overcrowd his department and spoil the record he was trying to make, but he said not a word except, "All right." And so Jurgis became a working man once more, and straightway he sought out his old friends and joined the union and began to root for Scotty Doyle. Doyle had done him a good turn once, he explained, and was really a bully chap. Doyle was a working man himself and would represent the working man. Why did they want to vote for a millionaire Sheeny, and what the hell had Mike Scully ever done for them that they should back his candidates all the time? And meantime, Scully had given Jurgis a note to the Republican leader of the ward, and he had gone there and met the crowd he was to work with. Already, they had hired a big hall with some of the brewer's money, and every night Jurgis brought in a dozen new members of the Doyle Republican Association. Pretty soon, they had a grand opening night, and there was a brass band which marched through the streets and fireworks and bombs and red lights in front of the hall. And there was an enormous crowd with two overflow meetings, so that the pale and trembling candidate had to recite three times over the little speech which one of Scully's henchmen had written, and which he had been a month learning by heart. Best of all, the famous and eloquent Senator Spareshanks, presidential candidate, rode out in an automobile to discuss the sacred privileges of American citizenship and protection and prosperity for the American working man. His inspiriting address was quoted to the extent of half a column in all the morning newspapers, which also said that it could be stated upon excellent authority that the unexpected popularity developed by Doyle, the Republican candidate for alderman, was giving great anxiety to Mr. Scully, the chairman of the Democratic City Committee. The chairman was still more worried when the monster torchlight procession came off, with the members of the Doyle Republican Association all in red capes and hats, and free beer for every voter in the ward, the best beer ever given away in a political campaign, as the whole electorate testified. During this parade, and at innumerable cart-tail meetings as well, Jurgis labored tirelessly. He did not make any speeches. There were lawyers and other experts for that, but he helped to manage things, distributing notices and posting placards and bringing out the crowds, and when the show was on, he attended to the fireworks and the beer. Thus, in the course of the campaign, he handled many hundreds of dollars of the Hebrew brewer's money, administering it with naive and touching fidelity. Towards the end, however, he learned that he was regarded with hatred by the rest of the boys, because he compelled them either to make a poorer showing than he
or to do without their share of the pie. After that, Jorgis did his best to please them, and to make up for the time he had lost before he discovered the extra bungholes of the campaign barrel. He pleased Mike Scully also. On election morning, he was out at 4 o'clock getting the vote. He had a 2-horse carriage to ride in, and he went from house to house for his friends and escorted them in triumph to the polls. He voted 6 times himself and voted some of his friends as often. He brought bunch after bunch of the newest foreigners, Lithuanians, Poles, Bohemians, Slovaks, and when he had put them through the mill, he turned them over to another man to take to the next polling place. When Jurgis first set out, the captain of the precinct gave him $100, and 3 times in the course of the day he came for another 100, and not more than 25 out of each lot got stuck in his own pocket. The balance all went for actual votes, and on a day of Democratic landslides, they elected Scotty Doyle, the ex-10-pin setter, by nearly 1,000 plurality. And beginning at 5 o'clock in the afternoon and ending at 3 the next morning, Jurgis treated himself to a most unholy and horrible jag. Nearly everyone else in Packingtown did the same, however, for there was universal exultation over this triumph of popular government, this crushing defeat of an arrogant plutocrat by the power of the common people. Chapter 26. After the elections, Jurgis stayed on in Packingtown and kept his job. The agitation to break up the police protection of criminals was continuing, and it seemed to him best to lay low for the present. He had nearly $300 in the bank, and might have considered himself entitled to a vacation, but he had an easy job, and force of habit kept him at it. Besides, Mike Scully, whom he consulted, advised him that something might turn up before long. Jurgis got himself a place in a boarding house with some congenial friends. He had already inquired of Agnelli and learned that Elzbieta and her family had gone downtown, and so he gave no further thought to them. He went with a new set now, young unmarried fellows who were sporty. Jurgis had long ago cast off his fertilizer clothing, and since going into politics, he had donned a linen collar and a greasy red necktie. He had some reason for thinking of his dress, for he was making about $11 a week, and 2/3 of it he might spend upon his pleasures without ever touching his savings. Sometimes he would ride downtown with a party of friends to the cheap theaters and the music halls and other haunts with which they were familiar. Many of the saloons in Packingtown had pool tables and some of them bowling alleys, by means of which he could spend his evenings in petty gambling. Also, there were cards and dice. One time Jurgis got into a game on a Saturday night and won prodigiously, and because he was a man of spirit, he stayed in with the rest, and the game continued until late Sunday afternoon. And by that time, he was out over $20. On Saturday nights also, a number of balls were generally given in Packingtown. Each man would bring his girl with him, paying $0.50 for a ticket, and several dollars additional for drinks in the course of the festivities, which continued until 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, unless broken up by fighting. During all this time, the same man and woman would dance together, half stupefied with sensuality and drink. Before long, Jurgis discovered what Scully had meant by something turning up. In May, the agreement between the Packers and the unions expired, and a new agreement had to be signed. Negotiations were going on, and the yards were full of talk of a strike. The old scale had dealt with the wages of the skilled men only, and of the members of the meat workers' union, about 2/3 were unskilled men. In Chicago, these latter were receiving, for the most part, 18.5 cents an hour, and the unions wished to make this the general wage for the next year. It was not nearly so large a wage as it seemed. In the course of the negotiations, the union officers examined time checks to the amount of $10,000, and they found that the highest wages paid had been $14 a week, the lowest $2.05, and the average of the whole, $6.65. And $6.65 was hardly too much for a man to keep a family on. Considering the fact that the price of dressed meat had increased nearly 50% in the last 5 years, while the price of beef on the hoof had decreased as much, it would have seemed that the Packers ought to be able to pay it, but the Packers were unwilling to pay it. They rejected the union demand, and to show what their purpose was, a week or two after the agreement expired, they put down the wages of about 1,000 men to 16.5 cents. and it was said that Old Man Jones had vowed he would put them to 15 before he got through. There were 1.5 million men in the country looking for work, 100,000 of them right in Chicago, and were the packers to let the union stewards march into their places and bind them to a contract that would lose them several $1,000 a day for a year? Not much. All this was in June, and before long the question was submitted to a referendum in the unions, and the decision was for a strike. It was the same in all the packing house cities, and suddenly the newspapers and public woke up to face the gruesome spectacle of a meat famine. All sorts of pleas for reconsideration were made, but the packers were obdurate, and all the while they were reducing wages and heading off shipments of cattle and rushing in wagon loads of mattresses and cots. So the men boiled over, and one night telegrams went out from the union headquarters to all the big packing centers, to St. Paul, South Omaha, Sioux City, St. Joseph, Kansas City, East St. Louis, and New York. And the next day at noon, between 50 and 60,000 men drew off their working clothes and marched out of the factories, and the great beef strike was on. Jurgis went to his dinner, and afterwards he walked over to see Mike Scully, who lived in a fine house upon a street which had been decently paved and lighted for his especial benefit. Scully had gone into semi-retirement and looked nervous and worried. "What do you want?" he demanded when he saw Jurgis. "I came to see if maybe you could get me a place during the strike," the other replied. And Scully knit his brows and eyed him narrowly. In that morning's papers, Jurgis had read a fierce denunciation of the packers by Scully, who had declared that if they did not treat their people better, the city authorities would end the matter by tearing down their plants. Now, therefore, Jurgis was not a little taken aback when the other demanded suddenly, "See here, Rutkus, why don't you stick by your job?" Jurgis started. "Work as a scab?" he cried. "Why not?" demanded Scully. "What's that to you?" But... stammered Jurgis. He had somehow taken it for granted that he should go out with the union. "The packers need good men and need 'em bad," continued the other, "and they'll treat a man right that stands by them. Why don't you take your chance and fix yourself?" "But," said Jurgis, "how could I ever be of any use to you in politics?" "You couldn't be it anyhow," said Scully abruptly. "Why not?" asked Jurgis. "Hell, man," cried the other. "Don't you know you're a Republican, and you think I'm always going to elect Republicans? My brewers found out already how he served them, and there's the deuce to pay." Jurgis looked dumbfounded. He had never thought of that aspect of it before. "I could be a Democrat," he said. "Yes," responded the other, "but not right away. A man can't change his politics every day. And besides, I don't need you. There'd be nothing for you to do, and it's a long time to election day anyhow. And what are you going to do meantime?" "I thought I could count on you," began Jurgis. "Yes," responded Scully, "so you could. I never yet went back on a friend, but is it fair to leave the job I got you and come to me for another? I've had 100 fellows after me today. What can I do? I put 17 men on the city payroll to clean streets this 1 week, and do you think I can keep that up forever? It wouldn't do for me to tell other men what I tell you, but you've been on the inside, and you ought to have sense enough to see for yourself. What have you to gain by a strike?" "I hadn't thought," said Jurgis. "Exactly," said Scully. "But you'd better. Take my word for it. The strike will be over in a few days, and the men will be beaten. And meantime, what you get out of it will belong to you. Do you see?" And Jurgis saw. He went back to the yards and into the workroom. The men had left a long line of hogs in various stages of preparation, and the foreman was directing the feeble efforts of a score or two of clerks and stenographers and office boys to finish up the job and get them into the chilling rooms. Jurgis went straight up to him and announced, "I have come back to work, Mr. Murphy." The boss's face lighted up. "Good man," he cried. "Come ahead." "Just a moment," said Jurgis, checking his enthusiasm. "I think I ought to get a little more wages." "Yes," replied the other. "Of course. What do you want?" Jurgis had debated on the way. His nerve almost failed him now, but he clenched his hands. "I think I ought to have $3 a day," he said. "All right," said the other promptly, and before the day was out, our friend discovered that the clerks and stenographers were getting $5 a day, and then he could have kicked himself. So Jurgis became one of the new American heroes, a man whose virtues merited comparison with those of the martyrs of Lexington and Valley Forge. The resemblance was not complete, of course, for Jurgis was generously paid and comfortably clad, and was provided with a spring cot and a mattress and 3 substantial meals a day. Also, he was perfectly at ease and safe from all peril of life and limb, save only in the case that a desire for beer should lead him to venture outside of the stockyard's gates. And even in the exercise of this privilege, he was not left unprotected. A good part of the inadequate police force of Chicago was suddenly diverted from its work of hunting criminals and rushed out to serve him. The police and the strikers also were determined that there should be no violence, but there was another party interested which was minded to the contrary, and that was the press. On the first day of his life as a strikebreaker, Jurgis quit work early, and in a spirit of bravado he challenged 3 men of his acquaintance to go outside and get a drink. They accepted, and went through the big Halsted street gate, where several policemen were watching, and also some Union pickets, scanning sharply those who passed in and out. Jurgis and his companions went south on Halsted Street past the hotel, and then suddenly 6 men started across the street towards them, and proceeded to argue with them concerning the error of their ways. As the arguments were not taken in the proper spirit, they went on to threats. And suddenly one of them jerked off the hat of one of the 4 and flung it over the fence. The man started after it, and then, as a cry of "scab" was raised and 12 people came running out of saloons and doorways, a 2nd man's heart failed him and he followed. Jurgis and the 4th stayed long enough to give themselves the satisfaction of a quick exchange of blows, and then they, too, took to their heels and fled back of the hotel and into the yards again. Meantime, of course, policemen were coming on a run, and as a crowd gathered, other police got excited and sent in a riot call. Jurgis knew nothing of this, but went back to Packers Avenue, and in front of the Central Time Station, he saw one of his companions, breathless and wild with excitement, narrating to an ever-growing throng how the 4 had been attacked and surrounded by a howling mob and had been nearly torn to pieces. While he stood listening, smiling cynically, several dapper young men stood by with notebooks in their hands, and it was not more than 2 hours later that Jurgis saw newsboys running about with armfuls of newspapers printed in red and black letters 6 inches high, "Violence in the Yards! Strikebreakers surrounded by frenzied mob!" If he had been able to buy all the newspapers of the United States the next morning, he might have discovered that his beer-hunting exploit was being perused by some 2 score millions of people, and had served as a text for editorials in 1/2 the staid and solemn businessmen's newspapers in the land. Jurgis was to see more of this as time passed. For the present, his work being over, he was free to ride into the city, by a railroad direct from the yards, or else to spend the night in a room where cots had been laid in rows. He chose the latter, but to his regret, for all night long, gangs of strikebreakers kept arriving. As very few of the better class of working men could be got for such work, these specimens of the new American hero contained an assortment of the criminals and thugs of the city. Besides Negroes and the lowest foreigners, Greeks, Romanians, Sicilians, and Slovaks. They had been attracted more by the prospect of disorder than by the big wages, and they made the night hideous with singing and carousing and only went to sleep when the time came for them to get up to work. In the morning, before Jurgis had finished his breakfast, Pat Murphy ordered him to one of the superintendents, who questioned him as to his experience in the work of the killing room. His heart began to thump with excitement, for he divined instantly that his hour had come, that he was to be boss. Some of the 4 men were Union members, and many who were not had gone out with the men. It was in the killing department that the Packers had been left most in the lurch, and precisely here that they could least afford it. The smoking and canning and salting of meat might wait, and all the byproducts might be wasted, but fresh meats must be had, or the restaurants and hotels and brownstone houses would feel the pinch, and then public opinion would take a startling turn. An opportunity such as this would not come twice to a man, and Jurgis seized it. Yes, he knew the work, the whole of it, and he could teach it to others. But if he took the job and gave satisfaction, he would expect to keep it. They would not turn him off at the end of the strike. To which the superintendent replied that he might safely trust Durham's for that. They proposed to teach these unions a lesson, and most of all those foremen who had gone back on them. Jurgis would receive $5 a day during the strike and $25 a week after it was settled. So our friend got a pair of slaughter pen boots and jeans and flung himself at his task. It was a weird sight there on the killing beds, a throng of stupid black Negroes and foreigners who could not understand a word that was said to them, mixed with pale-faced, hollow-chested bookkeepers and clerks, half-fainting for the tropical heat and the sickening stench of fresh blood, and all struggling to dress a dozen or two of cattle in the same place where, 24 hours ago, the old killing gang had been speeding with their marvelous precision, turning out 400 carcasses every hour. The Negroes and the toughs from the levee did not want to work, and every few minutes some of them would feel obliged to retire and recuperate. In a couple of days, Durham and Company had electric fans up to cool off the rooms for them, and even couches for them to rest on. In meantime, they could go out and find a shady corner and take a snooze. And as there was no place for anyone in particular and no system, it might be hours before their boss discovered them. As for the poor office employees, they did their best, moved to it by terror. 30 of them had been fired in a bunch that first morning for refusing to serve, besides a number of women clerks and typewriters who had declined to act as waitresses. It was such a force as this that Jurgis had to organize. He did his best, flying here and there, placing them in rows and showing them the tricks. He had never given an order in his life before, but he had taken enough of them to know, and he soon fell into the spirit of it, and roared and stormed like any old stager. He had not the most tractable pupils, however. "See here, boss," a big black buck would begin. "If you don't like the way I does this job, you can get somebody else to do it." Then a crowd would gather and listen, muttering threats. After the first meal, nearly all the steel knives had been missing, and now every Negro had one, ground to a fine point, hidden in his boots. There was no bringing order out of such a chaos, Jurgis soon discovered, and he fell in with the spirit of the thing. There was no reason why he should wear himself out with shouting. If hides and guts were slashed and rendered useless, there was no way of tracing it to anyone, and if a man lay off and forgot to come back, there was nothing to be gained by seeking him, for all the rest would quit in the meantime. Everything went during the strike, and the packers paid. Before long, Jurgis found that the custom of resting had suggested to some alert minds the possibility of registering at more than one place and earning more than $5 a day. When he caught a man at this, he fired him, but it chanced to be in a quiet corner, and the man tendered him a $10 bill and a wink, and he took them. Of course, before long, this custom spread, and Jurgis was soon making quite a good income from it. In the face of handicaps such as these, the packers counted themselves lucky if they could kill off the cattle that had been crippled in transit, and the hogs that had developed disease. Frequently, in the course of a 2 or 3 days' trip, in hot weather and without water, some hog would develop cholera and die, and the rest would attack him before he had ceased kicking. And when the car was opened, there would be nothing of him left but the bones. If all the hogs in this carload were not killed at once, they would soon be down with the dread disease, and there would be nothing to do but make them into lard. It was the same with the cattle that were gored and dying, or were limping with broken bones stuck through their flesh. They must be killed, even if brokers and buyers and superintendents had to take off their coats and help drive and cut and skin them. In meantime, agents of the packers were gathering gangs of Negroes in the country districts of the far south, promising them $5 a day and board, and being careful not to mention there was a strike. Already carloads of them were on the way, with special rates from the railroads, and all traffic ordered out of the way. Many towns and cities were taking advantage of the chance to clear out their jails and workhouses. In Detroit, the magistrates would release every man who agreed to leave town within 24 hours, and agents of the packers were in the courtrooms to ship them right. And meantime, trainloads of supplies were coming in for their accommodation, including beer and whiskey, so that they might not be tempted to go outside. They hired 30 young girls in Cincinnati to pack fruit, and when they arrived, put them at work canning corned beef, and put cots for them to sleep in a public hallway through which the men passed. As gangs came in day and night under the escort of squads of police, they stowed them away in unused workrooms and storerooms and in the car sheds, crowded so closely together that the cots touched. In some places, they would use the same room for eating and sleeping, and at night the men would put their cots upon the tables to keep away from the swarms of rats. But with all their best efforts, the packers were demoralized. 90% of the men had walked out, and they faced the task of completely remaking their labor force. And with the price of meat up 30% and the public clamoring for a settlement, they made an offer to submit the whole question at issue to arbitration. And at the end of 10 days, the unions accepted it, and the strike was called off. It was agreed that all the men were to be reemployed within 45 days, and that there was to be no discrimination against the union men. This was an anxious time for Jurgis. If the men were taken back without discrimination, he would lose his present place. He sought out the superintendent, who smiled grimly and bade him wait and see. Durham's strikebreakers were few of them leaving. Whether or not the settlement was simply a trick of the Packers to gain time, or whether they really expected to break the strike and cripple the unions by the plan, cannot be said. But that night, there went out from the office of Durham & Company a telegram to all the big packing centers: employ no union leaders. And in the morning, when the 20,000 men thronged into the yards with their dinner pails and working clothes, Jurgis stood near the door of the hog trimming room, where he had worked before the strike, and saw a throng of eager men with a score or two of policemen watching them. And he saw a superintendent come out and walk down the line and pick out man after man that pleased him. And one after another came, and there were some men up near the head of the line who were never picked, they being the union stewards and delegates, and the men Jurgis had heard making speeches at the meetings. Each time, of course, there were louder murmurings and angrier looks. Over where the cattle butchers were waiting, Jurgis heard shouts and saw a crowd, and he hurried there. One big butcher, who was president of the Packing Trades Council, had been passed over 5 times, and the men were wild with rage. They had appointed a committee of 3 to go in and see the superintendent, and the committee had made 3 attempts, and each time the police had clubbed them back from the door. Then there were yells and hoots, continuing until at last the superintendent came to the door. "We all go back, or none of us do," cried 100 voices, and the other shook his fist at them and shouted, "You went out of here like cattle, and like cattle you'll come back." Then suddenly the big butcher president leaped upon a pile of stones and yelled, "It's off, boys, we'll all of us quit again." And so the cattle butchers declared a new strike on the spot, and gathering their members from the other plants where the same trick had been played, they marched down Packers Avenue, which was thronged with a dense mass of workers, cheering wildly. Men who had already got to work on the killing beds dropped their tools and joined them. Some galloped here and there on horseback, shouting the tidings, and with 30 minutes the whole of Packingtown was on strike again, and beside itself with fury. There was quite a different tone in Packingtown after this. The place was a seething cauldron of passion, and the scab who ventured into it fared badly. There were 1 or 2 of these incidents each day, the newspapers detailing them, and always blaming them upon the unions. Yet 10 years before, when there were no unions in Packingtown, there was a strike, and national troops had to be called, and there were pitched battles fought at night by the light of blazing freight trains. Packingtown was always a center of violence. In Whiskey Point, where there were 100 saloons and 1 glue factory, there was always fighting, and always more of it in hot weather. Anyone who had taken the trouble to consult the station house blotter would have found that there was less violence that summer than ever before. And this, while 20,000 men were out of work and with nothing to do all day but brood upon bitter wrongs. There was no one to picture the battle the union leaders were fighting, to hold this huge army in rank, to keep it from straggling and pillaging, to cheer and encourage and guide 100,000 people of 12 different tongues through 6 long weeks of hunger and disappointment and despair. Meantime, the Packers had set themselves definitely to the task of making a new labor force. 1,000 or 2 of strike breakers were brought in every night and distributed among the various plants. Some of them were experienced workers, butchers, salesmen, and managers from the Packers' branch stores, and a few union men who had deserted from other cities. But the vast majority were green Negroes from the cotton districts of the far south, and they were herded into the packing plants like sheep. There was a law forbidding the use of buildings as lodging houses unless they were licensed for the purpose and provided with proper windows, stairways, and fire escapes. But here, in a paint room, reached only by an enclosed chute, a room without a single window and only 1 door, 100 men were crowded upon mattresses on the floor. Up on the 3rd story of the hog house of Jonas's was a storeroom, without a window, into which they crowded 700 men, sleeping upon the bare springs of cots, and with a second shift to use them by day. And when the clamor of the public led to an investigation into these conditions, and the mayor of the city was forced to order the enforcement of the law, the packers got a judge to issue an injunction forbidding him to do it. Just at this time, the mayor was boasting that he had put an end to gambling and prize fighting in the city, but here a swarm of professional gamblers had leagued themselves with the police to fleece the strikebreakers. And any night, in the big open space in front of Brown's, one might see brawny Negroes stripped to the waist and pounding each other for money,